this week on COVID, race, and democracy.
In our case, it is a personal fight. They fight us personally, but it is also reflective of what they are doing to the rest of the working class.
A lawyer for Namibian workers has had his water and electricity cut off for a support of miners working for a Chinese state company.
The thing is that all of these jobs are being cut in South Africa. These jobs are being exported to Israeli companies which operate on land that is illegally occupied and directly complicit in brutalizing the Palestinian people. And now they are exporting that brutalization of the workers to South Africa.
The clover workers of South Africa are fighting an Israeli billionaire family who want to implement mass layoffs and shut plants so they can import products from Israel. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. We begin today's show with a growing struggle of unionized South African truck assembly workers who are fighting for a standardized pay rate. Hundreds of members of National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, also famously known as NUMSA, have been on strike since October 15th at the First Automobile Works, a Chinese state-owned company in Port Elizabeth. The company says they should not be bound by the Motor Industry Bargaining Council contract for assembly line workers manufacturing cars because they are manufacturing only trucks. NUMSA Eastern Cape Regional Secretary Mzanda Twani has said, "We want the company to contract instead with the Automobile Manufacturing Employers Association and its national bargaining forum, as do BMW, Ford, Isuzu, Mercedes-Benz, Nissan, Toyota, and Volkswagen." Twani says pay rates for truck assembly workers that are set by MIMCO are lower than those paid by truck assemblers by companies in the Automobile Manufacturers Employers Organization. For FAWA pays 39 rand per hour, while other assemblers pay 99. Also, the General Industrial Workers Union of South Africa, General Secretary John Apollos, talked about the critical strike at the Clover Dairy Company, owned by the Israeli billionaire Wertheim family.
The strike started on the 22nd of November. It's more than a month in place now. And it involves about more than 4,000 workers, and it's members from our union, as well as from the Food and Allied Workers Union, FAU. Basically, the strike centers around massive job cuts and also the kind of major restructuring of the operations of the company, which involves the downscaling, down variation of workers' conditions of employment. Clover retrenched approximately 874 workers at the end of November. They also imposing salary cuts of 20%. They are also introducing certain changes in the working hours and also the operation systems. For example, they are imposing a 12-hour a day. Workers are currently working 9 hours. They want a 12-hour day with no overtime. We call it here a compressed working week, where workers work 4 days, 12 hours, with no overtime on a daily basis. And also they want to change some of the operational systems. For example, if there is a slack in demand, they want to have the right to inform permanent workers not to report for duty. And if they are not obliged to come to work, then they will not get the normal pay. So it's like a permanent short time arrangement and the flexibility around it. Also, they want to impose what is called a one van assistant, one driver. Currently, there are two van assistants and one driver. So when workers go on the delivery routes, there's a driver and he has two van assistants to assist with the picking of orders in the truck and offloading of the orders to the major customers. Also, they want to cut down on the transport allowance. They also want to offset if they offset overtime against short time. For example, if you work overtime but also you are forced to also work short time. Then instead of them paying you overtime, they can then use the overtime to fill in for your normal time whilst you were on short time. Now, the 874 workers are just this is in fact the second batch of workers that have been retrenched, that have lost their jobs. In June, July, approximately 856 workers lost their jobs through voluntary separations. And then Clover is intending to retrench another 812 workers at the end of February next year. They want to close down one of their branches and relocate it to another area. And in that process, 812 workers are possibly going to lose their jobs. So there's a major onslaught on the side of Clover against workers' conditions and their jobs. In 2019, the Central Bottling Company set up a consortium, which is called Milco, wherein the Central Bottling Company, CBC, has a majority shareholding. They then made an offer to purchase the shares of Clover, to take over Clover. And CBC is an Israeli-based company, and it's operating in the occupied territories of Palestine. And they were the ones who then put in a bid to take over Clover by setting up this Milco consortium. We then, as the unions, oppose this merger of Clover and Milco and CBC. It went to the what we call the Competition Commission, and the Competition Commission kind of accepted the merger on certain conditions. And one of the conditions is that the Clover Milco entity cannot retrench, cut jobs for a period of 3 years. In fact, they are supposed to create, as part of the conditions of the merger, create 550 new permanent jobs in a period of 5 years. So what we have instead is massive job losses rather than the creation of new jobs.
I understand your union is also calling for the nationalization of this company under workers' control. Is that true?
Yes. In fact, I mean, if you take the history of Clover, Clover was formed by a group of farmers in the early 1900s, and they set up a cooperative. And that cooperative lasted until 2003. So it was about, close to 90 years or even more that Clover was a cooperative rather than a public company or a normal corporation. So we feel that what must happen is that Clover must revert back to becoming a cooperative, and therefore the government must intervene and take over Clover and then turn it into a cooperative where workers are the major controllers and decision makers within the operation of that reconstituted enterprise in the form of a cooperative. And for us, I mean, where we're coming from is that we cannot have a situation where the major dairy producer and distributor in our country is being stripped down and its manufacturing capacity is just eroded for the sake of creating a foothold in the South African market for a foreign company which is involved in the major oppression and exploitation of Palestinian people. So, and also for us, secondly, if you look at the history of Clover, the original investment has been paid back to the shareholders many, many times over. And therefore, for us, that it must now become a company that is geared towards producing for the people rather than for a small minority in the form of profits.
This company, Central Bottling Company, owned by the Wertheim family, they also own the third largest bank in Israel. They have the license for Coca-Cola distribution in Israel. It seems like they've benefited from the United States, U.S. corporations helping them out. And also the founder of this company, Moshe Wertheim, was involved in the Mossad when Israel was an active supporter of the apartheid regime. Is this true?
Yes. In fact, if you look at some of the information that we got, especially from our fraternal organizations, like the Palestinian Solidarity Alliance, in fact, I mean, they were quite complicit in many of the actions of the Israeli Defense Force. In fact, they were even fined and charged for violating many of the competition rules and even in Israel. So this is a company that has a history of exploitation and oppression and violation of basic human rights. So we are not surprised that we see this kind of thing also happening in Clover. In fact, I mean, since CBC became the major shareholder, we have seen continuous attempts on the part of Clover to kind of push back the hard-won gains of our members and that of FAU. And therefore, for us, we are not surprised by all these kind of strategies that are now coming from the side of Clover to really push back workers 10, 20 years in terms of the levels of salaries and the level of conditions and hours of work.
And also the issue of health and safety and COVID, the dangers of COVID. One of the workers I saw said that they weren't provided proper protection uniforms working in these freezers, that the health and safety concerns your members have were a very important factor and why they're angry with their treatment.
Yeah, in fact, at the beginning of the pandemic here in South Africa, we had major battles with Clover. They just refused to shut down the plants where there was an outbreak of the virus. In areas like Bloemfontein, in areas like Clever, they just refused to shut down. We had to get the Department of Health to come and assist us in intervening and trying to get Clover to observe some of the COVID-19 protocols. Even with the situation of the delivery of products to the retailers, we said to them, look here, why don't you cut down on the routes and also the tonnage that workers must deliver to the various retail shops so that you can allow for social distancing within the trucks. They kind of refuse those particular measures. So Clover just sort of tried to undermine and ignore the COVID-19 protocols, and we had a major battle with them. And as I said, we had to resort to also involving the Department of Health to force them to close down some of the plants for 1 or 2 days so that, I mean, they can be sanitizing and the cleaning out of those particular plants.
That was GIW USA General Secretary John Apollos. These were some voices from the Clover picket line in South Africa.
There is restructuring in the company, which in total would result in, you know, job losses of over 1,400. One, two, there's the issue of wage cuts and wage freezes, which our members are rejecting, but also factory closures that would result, you know, in devastation of many towns like Lichtenberg, Hebron and others, where local economies are dependent in big factories of Clover. And we are saying that can be allowed to go unchallenged. And this is what our members are saying. We're opposed to factory closures, we're opposed to restructuring, we're opposed to long hours of work, we're opposed to wage cuts and wage freezes. And we are saying that this is a time when we should be creating more jobs, not cutting jobs.
What we're seeing is that all of these jobs are being cut in South Africa. These jobs are being exported to Israeli companies which operate on land that is illegally occupied and directly complicit in brutalizing the Palestinian people. And now they are exporting that brutalization of the workers to South Africa. We say there cannot be foreign investments in a company with job slashing, with job cutting. Half of the country is hungry. Half of the country is unemployed. This is a fight for all of the united working classes. And we're also calling for a public boycott. We call on everyone to show support and solidarity with the workers at Clover by boycotting all of the Clover products, going into shops, pulling them off the aisles, not purchasing anything produced by Clover. We really need solidarity to see a strong working class victory. And what is at stake is the conditions of whether or not workers in South Africa are allowed to live under conditions of dignity or not. So it's a struggle for all of us as the united working class.
anfunu fana na baniga sella.
That was Imthwalo by Zahara Thikwane. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Next, in Namibia last September 9th, union leaders of the Rossen uranium mine were fired by the state-owned China National Nuclear Corporation. They are still fighting to get their jobs back, and the Namibian government has shut off water and electricity at the home of their lawyer, Haywood Bukes.
Hey, Erica is my wife. We've been together for a very long time. Actually, we grew up together, and we started our political relationship in 1974 when we organized the socialist youth clandestinely, because at that time the communist legislation was here. And we were very much part of the struggle for independence. And we invariably came into conflict with the nationalist leadership of the SWAPO, because we joined SWAPO in 1976. We were part of the SWAPO Youth League, who was a sort of independent youth movement. Our whole adult life was spent on the liberation struggle and the clandestine building of a socialist movement. Come independence, we were also deeply involved in the union struggles from the early 70s. And in 1984, Erica founded the Committee of Parents, which fought against the mass killings and jailings of SWAPO members in exile by the leadership of SWAPO leadership and the so-called frontline states. And in 1990, the country gained independence. And then we were fighting for to try and stem the degeneration of the working class movement by an opportunist leadership. And she formed the Workers' Advice Center. And through the Workers' Advice Center, we tried to work with shop stewards, with working class leaders, because there was wholesale betrayal by the union leaders, abandonment of the unions, and there was privatization, massive privatization, etc. All these attacks took place during the 90s. As a result, we were in frontal conflict with the new regime. And this regime was supported by the imperialists. So it was literally a running battle over the past 31 years of independence. And so this is the reason why they started to attack us. Like the old colonial power, they attacked our livelihood. We didn't get jobs and so on. At times it was extremely difficult and so on. Then they started to fight us personally. At one point they cut the prepaid electricity. First they cut the water. And then a number of court cases, they actually made finding judgments that outlawed us from access to any running water or electricity. The comrades from England, our comrades from the Workers International, literally sustained us on on these questions because we did not have electricity and they barred us from running water, and which was illegal, strictly illegal from a legal point of view. And we re-established the water ourselves. We took law in our own hands and established the water ourselves. So, because we couldn't otherwise. But we blocked them from entering the premises. And then they took us to court with the First National Bank and they sold our house illegally. Everything they'd done against us, they did illegally. And so we are still fighting around the house, and I'm going to defend the court case myself because these lawyers they don't have a political consciousness to be able to do that. But I'm being assisted by comrades who are legal experts. So we are going to fight it that way. The case of the house is now in the Supreme Court under appeal. But in the meantime, they decided to cut our water. It's the first time that I started to realize that solidarity comes in a drum of water, because many people brought drums of water here. It was nice to see that people cared that much, but my house is full of drums of water now. Okay, in our case, it is a personal fight. They fight us personally. It's very specific. But it is also reflective of what they are doing to the rest of the working class. Because there's a lot of thievery and fraud going around. They get monies from these imperialists ostensibly to maintain the water supplies, especially during COVID-19. But they cut water to force working class families to find money somewhere to go and pay them. So they get a double income, one from the imperialists and one from the working class for the same service. That is the level of thievery that takes place here. But in our case, it is personally honed as a political attack. We won 2 seats in parliament in the 2014 election. We are the Workers' Revolutionary Party to rebuild the Fourth International. We won 2 seats, but the American embassy and the EU warned these fellows to keep us out of parliament. And so that we were never able to utilize the parliament. And at the same time, the Speaker of Parliament stole the money that was destined for the Workers' Revolutionary Party. So they owe us quite a bit, but it's money we'll never recoup. So that is the story of the situation. What I need to say is that because the comrades from Britain and the working class workers, comrades of Rossing and the fishermen and so on, have sent objections, protests to the Supreme Court, to the High Court, and to the president and to the mayor of Windhoek on this victimization, which meant an enormous amount for us. I mean, besides the morale booster and the humanity of it all, this was quite a necessary gesture from comrades to do, because once these people have failed to subdue us through those means, they obviously, I mean, the American imperialists, all imperialists are killers, and we were beginning to be concerned for especially my life. But as I say, we live by the maxim that we are not living on the dictates of somebody else. We live on what we consider as necessary to do. So if you decide to kill us, that's your decision. You can do that. We will do what we have to do. We cannot let bloody murderers and rapscallions dictate how we are going to conduct our lives. We are against this total destruction of the whole economy of the countries. Everywhere it's the same. It takes different forms depending on the situation of the country. This is a semi-colony, so to speak. It's used purely for extractive purposes. In places like Zimbabwe and so on, they destroy the skills that could have led to industrialization. They are destroying industrialization in South Africa and so on. So even though the forms of destruction may differ from country to country, but the destruction is there for all to see. And it's for us to intervene. And if we cannot intervene successfully, then obviously it's the end of humanity. So we've got only one task, and that is to seriously intervene in this destruction. And that's what we are going to do. And we have put our hope in the working class. We are very satisfied of the developments in a place like Namibia. And we are also very glad that we have been able to rally international support for this. And it seems that we are putting the ship to sea. And so that is for us extremely important. The support, we need support, but it's only for, in the case of the services that they have taken from us, cut from us. We need to take them to court for what they call a mandamus, because our laws prohibit this kind of actions. We need that, but we also need petitions from the comrades internationally to let them know that we are not alone. It is necessary for our safety, our physical safety. I wouldn't like these bastards to put me to sleep in the dark. If they do it in the light, that's okay. But not in the dark. But the question now is not, the concentration should not be on supporting us as a family. It should be on supporting these fellows at Rossing to do their job. And that is to rally the, firstly, the entire mining workers community, and to gather simultaneously the other sections of the working class together.
Lawyer Haywood Bukes. Sakani by Paul Ndlovu. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. South African tradingist and researcher David Hempson talked to us about the role of Chinese investments in Africa. What was the history of the Rossi mine in Namibia, the Freedom of Namibia?
Well, it was a critically important mine in terms of Western uranium policy, you see, and the development of, a nuclear power internationally. I think it was particularly good quality uranium. And for that, it had a high stock. Now, I didn't know much about the struggle of the workers. They were involved in 1971-72 when I was there, although it was impossible to go there because they had security all around the place. You just wouldn't get near. But they eventually, come independence and change there. They have organized themselves. But with the coming in of the Chinese nuclear corporation, I can't believe what's happened. That whole union agreement has been completely thrown out of the window. The key workers have been fired, and they put Chinese contractors meaning it's somebody standing there. If you want a job, come to me. I'll give you a job for a day, maybe 2 days if you're lucky. You had a full-time job. Now you're reduced to this pittance. And you now have to turn up and do everything as said and by this contractor. And that contractor is not even a person who's a citizen of that country. It's mind-boggling. Now we're looking in South Africa. We haven't quite got to that extent, but South African workers don't even know this is happening. I've learned about this by reading a little about what's happening. And we have to pass on the news to South Africa. This is what's going to happen if you do not organize and we change society completely and actually reorganize the economic base. All the labor rights and paper, don't count for anything unless you actually change the base of society. We're not going to be able to have a decent living, under the present conditions, and we could even see it get worse. Mm.
China's argued with its investments, Silk Road and the BRICS, that it is helping develop Africa, Asia, Latin America, by investing in infrastructure and helping out the people of these countries develop the infrastructure. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, just remember what colonialism did in Africa. Africa was a continent which had a certain unity in a sense. There was, there were no things as borders. There were no separate languages. People intermarried. There was, I wouldn't say it was perfection. But there were kingdoms. There was development. It's hard to believe it now. But the British were impressed when they arrived in the area which they now call Nigeria by the wealth of the people. And now those people have been degraded, through colonialism and through unequal exchange and all the rest of it. But to look at what's happened now with the Chinese investment, let me just go back to the colonial idea. The colonies were all divided up. By the agreements that were made in Berlin and thereafter. And each imperialist power created countries which they stuck together with entirely arbitrary barriers. And then they developed the infrastructure. In other words, a rail system to go back to the empire, another rail system to go, and roads to, in other words, to extract the riches of Africa. There was no coordination across countries. Even now, it's bizarre that there is so little integration, throughout Africa. The trade inside Africa is only something like 12% of the total trade of Africa is within. In the European Union, for what that's worth, it's something like 70%. So Africa is disunited, it's fragmented. Now China offers to develop the infrastructure. What does it do? It develops with the national state. And of course, we have corrupt regimes from top to bottom. They're very keen to be able to develop and maybe develop mining or something else that the Chinese would come in and do it. And they develop the rail system. Maybe it's improved. Yes, it will definitely be improved from what colonialism offered. But it's not going to cut across the countries and develop Africa as a whole, develop the continent. It's not aimed to do that. It's fracturing. It's reinforcing the fracturing of Africa. And on top of it, to make it easy, as in Zimbabwe and elsewhere, and in Namibia, and in how many Zambia and many other countries, they work together with a one-party state regime, the state apparatus, the ruling party. There's money flowing at that. And then the state will then do the protection for them. They will then organize everything and the contracts and all of that to be able to accommodate, you know, the Chinese. So there's money flowing. There's development of a certain type, but it's not structured according to the African continent and the integration of Africa and the interpenetration and the unification of Africa. It reinforces that fragmentation. And then there's debts. Those debts, as is happening, particularly in Zambia, they're found with something like five times what was originally officially reported. Now you've got to pay back these debts. Now these debts cannot be repaid. That's a fact. But the Chinese are going to hold, you know, the Chinese bureaucracy is going to hold Zambia, you know, to get to pay them, at least to give them 80% of what they've decided. Eventually, it's going to be a disaster for the Chinese bureaucracy because it's powerful enough an economy to take such little problems, $1 billion here, $1 billion there. But it's counterproductive to developing the national economy, let's put it that way, even on a capitalist basis, but certainly and most emphatically, it's counterproductive to workers' rights. I mean, the behavior of the Chinese bureaucracy in Namibia is unspeakable. And that's the same as happens in Zimbabwe and elsewhere. Apparently, you know, I'm hearing from what's happening in Zimbabwe, the miners there are just wrecking, the Chinese-owned mining companies are just wrecking rural communities, and they couldn't give a damn. There's no control. There's no environmental control over those guys. They do their own thing because they've been given the green light from above.
And the issue of socialism with Chinese characteristics, which Xi Jinping is developing in China, you had in SWAPO saying SWAPO is developing socialism with Chinese characteristics. SWAPO also was involved, the officers and the Minister of Fisheries and Justice, in selling off the licenses, being bribed to give licenses to the Icelandic fishing company that has led the fishermen destitute and loss of their jobs. This corruption, it seems to be endemic, and also the judicial system, the corruption of the judicial system. Is this a system-wide problem for the people of Africa now?
Well, it's becoming that. The problem, Steve, is that, you know, in a national liberation struggle, which has characterized much of Africa against colonialism, we've established there's a vision for a complete transformation. Maybe there was that vision. In many countries, there was. And people want to change everything from top to bottom. But every state has not done away with the detention laws under colonialism. Very little of the actual legislation of British colonialism or French colonialism is removed from the state. That's just one element. The ruling elite, well, you have a ruling elite. They are confronting a world system of inequality on which they're a small bit player, and they struggle to do. So sometimes they talk anti-imperialist and all the rest of it, but they'll never go too far because they know where their bread and butter is coming from. They know that in the end, they have to make peace with America, with the world system and so forth. So they look on a nationalist basis to holding on to power. Every regime which has come to power, the first priority is to stay in power. They do not look to unifying Africa. Everyone talks Pan-Africanism, but actually in the speeches, if you listen to them, particularly when they're not speaking in English or in French, is they suddenly mention this or that, and you ask, what is all that about? Oh, you didn't know. I said, oh, well, I'm a sucker. I didn't know. He said, oh, that's that group there, which he doesn't approve of. Those are the Shangaans that didn't want here. Well, it's the Malawians. Malawians are the people who migrated from Malawi into Zimbabwe. Disgusting. If a white person said it, he'd be, you know, condemned from top to bottom. But it's all in the local language, and it's got away with. So, you know, you have this Pan-African in words, but in local language, you know, you're against, you know, opposing states or other countries, and particularly opposed to all kinds of minorities. So many minorities in Southern Africa and in Africa, you know, struggle. And so you have grievances developing and a splitting of countries. We don't need this national, we want the national and social tasks resolved. you know, by a thoroughgoing revolution, which ends in dealing with all the social problems. Sankara, the president who's celebrated in Burkina Faso, you know, he came to power. It wasn't the purest of regimes in a way, but look what the man did. I mean, he brought rights to women. He stopped the brutal assault on women just by mobilizing the women and mobilizing society and just saying it's not going to happen. He brought in vaccination so that the people are actually immune to so many of the diseases of Africa. And that was, I think, in a period of 3 years. Now we're sitting in stagnation. South Africa has a marvelous scientific base, and we cannot produce our own vaccines. We can't even reproduce the vaccines that are out there. Our society is going backwards. South Africa had a scientific base which created all kinds of innovations, you know, in the past, you know, such as reverse osmosis and things like that, which were patented in South Africa and then sold to other people. Our society hasn't got the intelligence politically to be able to develop all those treasures of our scientific base. So our society moves backwards, and we need a complete change to be able to move ahead for all our citizens, all classes, in the sense even the middle class should benefit, you know, from a thoroughgoing revolution.
South African trading and researcher David Hempson talked to us about the role of Chinese investments in Africa. That was Mwambe. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Western governments, along with their loyal media and think tanks, warn that China is colonizing, exploiting, and forcing Africa into a debt trap. Is this true, or is it Cold War propaganda? What is China's actual role in Africa, and how does it compare with the West? Rania Kolek of Breakthrough News spoke with two leading African leftists, Kambale Musavuli, an activist and writer and analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo, and Michaela Nahando Erskog, a researcher at the Tricontinental Institute, a member of the organizing committee of No Cold War, and an educator and researcher with Pan-Africanism Today, which works with organizations like NUMSTA in South Africa.
The issue of the propaganda on the African continent. How has this sort of Western-backed propaganda sparked anti-China sentiment in a place like the DRC, for example? And I just mean among the average population, not necessarily among government officials.
I think it's both ways. The propaganda exists, but there are some facts on the ground that allows also the propaganda to be pushed. So it's easy to get a video of one individual Chinese who's done in action against the locals, and then generalize the situation and say, oh, the Chinese state is doing A, B, C, D. And then it doesn't help. Now when you start getting the propaganda from the West about what China is doing, look at the video that circulated. I mean, those videos are real, of an abuse that took place somewhere of a Chinese worker with a local, but then it's extrapolated out of context. Now, the propaganda itself has the wrong premise. Let's look at the Belt and Road Initiative. Let's say it doesn't exist. Africa today has mineral resources. Africa is cash strapped. Africa needs development. The United States, Western powers, have demonstrated for 400 years the unwillingness to develop Africa or to be fair partners with Africa to build the infrastructure that Africa needs. So who will build the infrastructure of Africa without capital? China in the early 2000s understood it because they went through a process, right? The process that they went through allowed them to understand why it's important to exchange what you have and what they themselves can give. And in the case of DRC, that says, you have copper, you have cobalt, we need it. You need schools, you need hospitals, you need roads. We can provide that. Rather than you spending money to be able to pay for that, because we know you are cash strapped, you owe the World Bank billions of dollars. You know, at the time, it was about $14 billion that the Congo owed the World Bank. We will take amounts of copper and cobalt, and we will build this infrastructure for you. So that's the $9 billion deal that China had. $3 billion, a joint project between the DRC and China. And the $6 billion is the infrastructure project. And the $3 billion earmarked of the joint project will pay for the debt. So at the end of the process, Congo is debt-free. That's a perfect deal for the Congo. I mean, the deal is there, so people can look at it. But this is stopped by the World Bank and the IMF, where in 2008 and 2009, they start telling the Congo that they need to renegotiate the Chinese contract. So what they did by forcing the Congo to say, before we forgive your $14 billion debt that comes from the Mobutu era of a dictator that we, the United States, back installed for 32 years, had these loans that, you know, accrue in interest, ended up with Congo owing $14 billion, where we can show what actually the $14 billion bill. They said, before we forgive this debt, you need to renegotiate the Chinese contract. And they forced the Congolese government to remove the state guarantee of the $3 billion project and made Congo $6 billion in debt. So in 2021, we'll discuss that Congo has a $6 billion debt from the DRC, which was forced by the World Bank. So we understand what the propaganda is doing. The propaganda is allowing, is pushing for Africans to not look at the fact, to not actually look at what is happening, and actually make decisions that's against their own interest. Because the United States is not going to build the roads in the Congo. They're not interested in that. They're interested in profit. The United States is not going to help the DRC. They have a 100 years experience, right? We have a 100-year historical record of the United States engagement in the DRC. Now that China is ready to build infrastructure and they're able to do it, and that's actually what's happening on social media right now. This past month of September has been fascinating to see the Chinese ambassador, the foreign minister of China, actually posting on social media the accomplishment of China in the DRC. The Busanga Dam, the cultural center they're building, speaking about how they've paid billions of dollars of taxes to actually show the record of how much taxes they've paid to the DRC government. So they are listing the concrete project and what they've done in DRC. And September 22nd, 2021, the U.S. Embassy has the opportunity to show what the United States is doing in DRC. They put a selfie picture of the United States ambassador, the Congolese president, surrounded by U.S. military. So we understand what the propaganda is doing, pushing Africans to make decisions against their interests. We also know what China has done for the African continent and doing. And it's important to combat this myth of China as a colonial power, an exploitative power, when they're coming to the table and say, let's discuss and let's build this new world.
And I think that that really plays out in the way that each of these countries has responded to the world through over COVID, over the pandemic. On the one hand, you have the US literally denying entire areas of the world access to these vaccines simply by refusing to push its pharmaceutical companies to waive their vaccine patents. So I think the continent of Africa, like 2% of people have even been vaccinated, which is outrageous. While also, you know, the US was hoarding PPE and just, you had the exact opposite reaction from China. You know, China has been sending its vaccines abroad. It was sending protective equipment abroad. Okay, so has the US versus Chinese response to COVID to other parts of the world had an impact on the way that people view these two countries?
During this moment of the COVID pandemic, there are two things I think we also need to understand. China never left the African continent. I think with the BRI, Belt and Road Initiative project, at least 1,000 projects continued, building kept happening, even in this moment of crisis, with all the precautions, right? Because they have the infrastructure to produce those precautions. But then on the other hand is that they continue to, you know, remain in Africa in the same year that they've accomplished removing or alleviating over 800 million people out of extreme poverty. I mean, this is not talked about enough. The African continent knows extreme poverty. We know colonialism. China has experienced extreme poverty. They know colonialism. They know the humiliation that comes from foreign domination based on the 1800s, right? And they were able, in the space of 70 years, to uplift their population, the biggest population in one country, in a relatively short amount of time, right? So I think we need to remember that. And when you're saying, Kambale, about how China didn't leave us in our time of crisis, it reminded me of in 1963, December, 1964, January, Premier Zhou Enlai, the premier of China at the time, he visited Africa for the first time. He went on this amazing tour. And during that time, a coup attempt was made against Kwame Nkrumah, the then president of Ghana. And in that moment, you know, the Ghanaians are calling the Chinese saying, we understand if you guys can't come, we get it, it's fine. Actually, when Nehru from India tried to visit us, there was also a coup attempt and he decided to cancel. And Zhou Enlai sits back and says, no, we know your experience. We know the challenges of trying to build a humanizing alternative project. We are coming to visit you. Let's remove some of the security concerns. Let's remove some of the, you know, the pomp of diplomatic visits. But let us meet and let us talk, because the interests of Ghana are the interests of China. And that was what I've been thinking about the last, you know, 2 years of the COVID pandemic, and how China has not, in fact, left us in this moment of need. And just added to that is, I think we really do have to keep in mind also the fact that a lot of the China anti-China hysteria is consistently drummed up by African elites and African leaders. In Zambia, when the opposition, Michael Sata, was running for the presidency in 2006, all he could say against the then ruling party was, they're in cahoots with China. China's the reason why we have so many, you know, sovereign debt, etc. And this is consistently used across the continent, in South Africa, and in any kind of, you know, major corrupt country in Africa, China is scapegoated as a reason for the nation's problems. And it completely undermines the existence of our history of colonialism, our history of slavery, our history of neo and present history of neocolonialism, and the fact that the people who own and control the resources are not in fact dominated by the Chinese, but historically lie and continue to remain in the hands of European, you know, corporate elites. So I think that that's also important, is that the use of hysteria amongst the general population is always incited for specific personal interests of the ruling elite in the African continent. And that's why it's so important that we in Africa understand that China is here, they're presenting us with opportunities. What we can do in our countries is to build strong organizational structures that will enable us to actually influence those decision-making processes and spaces that would actually benefit the advancement of the human development on the continent.
That was the voice of Makhila Nahondo Erskog of Pan-Africanism Today, the No Cold War Coalition, and the Tricontinental Institute. Before her, we heard from Kambale Musavili with the Center for Research on the Congo. They spoke with journalist Rania Kolek at the Breakthrough News YouTube channel. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of the show. Today's program was produced by Steve Zeltzer, myself. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasilyev, and myself. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening.